This is the Countdown to Mickey podcast, where we take a new look and deep dive into the things we love at Walt Disney World and Disneyland. This is Michelle.
And this is Steve.
And this is the Countdown to Mickey podcast. Because of the pandemic, we've decided to postpone our next Disney trip for a year. We are typically annual pass holders and go quite a few times a year, so this was a huge change for us.
To help us get over our Disney depression, we decided to do a countdown of our favorite rides and really dive deep into our favorite attractions.
Welcome back to this week's episode, number 39.
Living with the Land.
And today we have a little special guest. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Not a little special guest. We have a very special guest.
Hi, everyone. This is Ben.
Our 9-year-old oldest son is going to give his thoughts on the ride. It opened in Epcot on opening day, October 1st, 1982. Only one refurbishment, which was in 1993. It actually opened as Listening to the Land and then was renamed in 1993 to Living with the Land. It's a 20-minute journey where you can see firsthand how Walt Disney World horticulturists are using innovative growing techniques and crossbreeding high-yield crops to help feed a growing planet. And this eye-opening tour, you'll be inspired by a hopeful vision of the farming's future. So this ride is broken down into two parts. During the first part of the ride, guests float through indoor scenes representing different biomes, such as the desert, the rainforest, and a prairie. And for the second part of the ride, guests learn about new agriculture methods and innovation to help mankind. So Ben, what's your favorite part of the ride?
My favorite part of the ride is when we get to see all the plants that they use to make the food that in Disney.
Yeah, that's my favorite part of the ride too. How about you, Steve?
Well, I have a few different favorite parts of the ride. I think it's not necessarily one individual scene that is my favorite part of the ride. I like more of the themes that are covered in the ride, especially the discussion about how we need to think about our agricultural practices and how we live with the land in a way that is sustainable and continues to help both mankind and the earth. So before we get into too many details about the ride, I think it's important to take a step back and talk about the location of the ride and why that plays such an important part of the ride. And so the Land Pavilion is made up of not just the Living with the Land ride, but also one of our favorite restaurants. So Ben, can you tell us about your favorite restaurant at Walt Disney World?
Garden Grill.
And what about Garden Grill makes it your favorite?
Because they serve almost a million things at once and you just chow down on everything.
Do you like seeing the different scenes as you go by?
Yeah, but I mostly like the food.
Mostly like the food.
So what's your favorite part of the food?
Waffles, because you get to put syrup and chocolate syrup on it, too.
So syrup and chocolate syrup on the waffles. And yeah, we love the Garden Grill because not only does it give you lots of really good food, but that food comes from the Living with the Land ride and the greenhouse that's a key part of the ride. And so we just wanted to make sure we talked about that important part because I think that makes so much about what makes the ride cool.
Yeah, and my favorite part is the salsa. You can just tell it is fresh. They made those ingredients. The eggs, of course, are nothing special. They're like the routine Disney scrambled eggs. But when you add the salsa, it makes it worth it. Right, Ben?
Okay, so getting back to the ride, let's talk a little bit about that first part of the ride, the dark section, where you get onto the boat and you are immediately immersed into this idea of biomes around the earth. And
it's a little scary at first because the first scene is like a thunderstorm.
Right. And do you know what biome that represents?
No.
So Ben, do you know what a biome is?
No.
So a biome, what's amazing about Earth is that it's so complex, it's so diverse, there's so many different things happening on Earth. And so to help us humans organize all of these different things that are happening, we kind of have to come up with a structure. We have to come up with some sort of organization, way to simplify all of these cool, complex things that happen on Earth. And so to do that, we've come up with this organization technique called a biome. And a biome just basically classifies climate, plants, and animals into these groupings.
How many are there?
Ben, do you know how many biomes there are on Earth?
A million?
So technically, you could have like an infinite number of biomes, depending on how detailed you want to get, depending on how closely you want to look at these differences. But to make it easy for us, we separate it into essentially 10 different biomes. And these biomes can be thought of as either terrestrial or water biomes or aquatic biomes. And so do you know what the difference between terrestrial and aquatic is?
Aquatic is not thick, and terrestrial is thick.
Well, what is aqua?
Aqua is water.
Yeah. So what do you think aquatic biomes are?
Earth?
So terrestrial biomes represents kind of land. So whenever you hear the word terrestrial, that means land. We've talked about the terrestrial planets in our solar system, those four terrestrial planets. Those are the rock planets or the land planets versus the gas planets. So terrestrial means land, and aquatic are the water. So we have our three aquatic, which is basically freshwater, saltwater, or marine, and ice. And so those three biomes actually take up majority of Earth, because a majority of Earth is water. And then we have our terrestrial biomes, which include tropical rainforest, temperate forest, desert, tundra, taiga, which is also the boreal forest, grassland, and savanna, tropical grassland. And so out of those terrestrial biomes, the taiga biome is actually the largest biome. And that's just your typical kind of forest that is your average forest that has mostly evergreen trees, these pine trees that populate a large portion of the Earth land. And so these biomes, it's great to kind of learn about these biomes, to travel through these biomes. We don't get to see all of them in Living with the Land, but we do get to see a couple of the differences. And so I think it's always fun to go at the beginning of this ride and think about, what biome do I currently live in or do I come from? And so Ben, do you remember what biome we live in? Here in Maryland?
A tropical?
Very close. It's actually subtropical. And so this is, again, how the biomes can be split into. Notice I didn't necessarily say subtropical, but we do live in a subtropical / temperate area in Maryland. And so we get a taste of that in the Living with the Land ride. During the thunderstorm, we've had crazy thunderstorms this summer, and we get to experience that a little bit with Living with the Land. But then we go to a next biome. Do you know what the next? Do you remember what is the next biome in Living with the Land, Michelle?
I thought it was desert.
Yeah, I think it goes the stormy scene, and then it goes to like a prairie scene, or I think maybe it does go desert and then prairie. And then we get to see the house. And so it's just a cool, quick exploration. I would love to get a little bit more depth in the biomes, but I think it does do a good job of just showing how there's so many different biomes here on Earth. And then we get to go into the next part. But before we go into the greenhouse piece, there's the house. And so the house, I think, is a really good representation of kind of how humans began to really interact with the land through agriculture and farming. And so do you remember the different animals that are in the house, Ben?
I remember lots of chickens.
Okay, so yeah, there's chickens, and there's the dog, remember? And there's something really special about that dog. Do you know what that dog actually represents? It's actually supposed to be Walt Disney's dog. And so they modeled that dog after Walt Disney's dog.
There's actually supposed to be a secret bedroom on the second floor that you can see only in the restaurant, too. Would you want to stay in that secret bedroom?
What? You can stay in it?
No, you can't. But there's a secret bedroom in there.
Are you allowed to see it?
Nope. You can only see it in the restaurant as it goes around for about 15 seconds. That's about it.
Wait, was the dog like Walt Disney's dog that he had when he was a kid?
We don't know when in his life, but it's supposed to be like modeled after his dog.
Interesting.
So after the house scene, then we get to get into the greenhouses, which is the second part of the tour. And the greenhouse part, do you have a favorite part of that second portion of the ride once we enter those greenhouses?
Because it shows them growing and it just smells amazing because you can smell all the fruit and vegetables.
Yeah, so the greenhouse does have a lot, again, where they're growing fruits and vegetables that they use throughout the park. And greenhouses are a very important part of our agricultural system. Do you know why greenhouses are so important, Ben?
Because they help grow. They help grow plants and help animals eat.
Well, there's no animals inside these greenhouses, or most greenhouses. But why do they help plants grow? Do you know when, like, why they're so important? Why they're such an important part of how we can grow plants to sustain, to have enough food for all the humans on Earth?
That the carbon dioxide and breathe out a lot of oxygen?
That is true. But greenhouses actually solve a very specific problem that we have, which is in the wintertime, most plants can't grow because the temperature's too cold. They don't have an environment where they can actually thrive. And so greenhouses actually allow us to grow food year-round and be able to produce food in times and in areas where we normally wouldn't be able to. And so there's some really cool science behind how greenhouses work. And the greenhouse, do you know why they're mostly made out of glass, these greenhouses?
So the snow can't get in?
Yep, that's one thing, to protect the plants that you're growing from the elements. And
but what do plants need?
Water.
Well, and what do they need that they can't get when you grow indoors?
Sunshine?
Sunlight, yeah. So when it's glass, they can get some of that sunlight.
Oh.
And so there's a couple other things that get to happen whenever you have glass as well. So when you go into a car on a really hot day, what does that feel like?
Feels like you're gonna melt.
Yeah, it feels even hotter. Well, actually, even when you go in on a car on a cold, sunny day. So when you go inside in the wintertime, it's a nice, sunny, bright day. What do you know what your car feels like when you go into it?
A million degrees.
It still feels hot. And so that's kind of the greenhouse. That's why how greenhouses work, is they let certain light in. They actually let infrared light into the greenhouse as well. So they let it in and then it actually traps that heat inside the greenhouse. And so it keeps it warm. It allows the plants to get the sunlight that they need to do photosynthesis, and it allows us to grow plants year round. And so the second part of the ride, again, dives right into some of these key technologies that we've been using to grow plants year-round and in a way that where we can feed this growing human population. And so before we get into some of the details about these greenhouses, our special guest has to go play with his brothers. And so we want to thank you, Ben, for joining us. And
thank you, Ben.
You're welcome.
And you want to say bye to our audience?
Okay, so let's break down the different greenhouses and talk about which one's our favorite. So the first one is a tropics greenhouse where they grow bananas, cacao, jackfruit, vanilla, pineapple, papaya. Then there's the aqua cell, which is the aquaculture or fish farming. And there are tilapia, sturgeon, paddlefish, catfish, and bass. And some of these fish are actually harvested for the Coral Reef Restaurant. Then there is the temperate greenhouse, and that usually has like pumpkins, winter melons, and they get the pumpkins to grow in Mickey shapes by having different molds that they allow the pumpkins to grow in. Then there's the string greenhouse, which focuses on nutrient film technique and their quote-unquote vertical growing techniques. And those produce like the tomatoes, the lettuce, the snake gourds, and then the creative greenhouse. And that is the final greenhouse, and it shows aeroponics, which is when a fine mist of water and nutrients is sprayed directly onto the roots of the plants. The roots dangle freely in the air and are not hindered by any soil or growing medium. So those are the different greenhouses. Steve, which one is your favorite?
I really like the creative greenhouse. I think that really shows how we can use many different techniques, and we can use really kind of full cycle farming. And so I especially like the tank with the fish on the bottom and the plants on the top. And so that shows how we can use aquaculture to grow plants. Basically, the fish poop becomes nutrients for the plants. And obviously, it's the water that the fish are living in that help feed the plants as well. And then the plants help clean the water for the fish. And so I think that's a very cool, creative way that certain farmers are using technology and using our increasing understanding about the natural world to make farming more sustainable. And so, yeah, there's really cool things in the creative ones. That's my favorite one. How about you? Which one's yours?
I think I like the string ones. I think it's pretty impressive. They have a Guinness World Record holder in there, a tomato plant that makes 32,000 tomatoes in a 16-month period. So I'm going to give it up to the string greenhouse where we get those awesome tomatoes for our salsa at Garden Grill. So about the greenhouses, which one do you think is the most innovative? Which ones do we actually use? And which ones do you think are just for show and we don't really use these techniques anymore?
Well, I think in the Behind the Seeds tour that we got to go on, we got to learn a little bit about how much these different techniques are being used. And I think it is a combination of show, but it does give some really good insights into how agriculture continues to evolve as we move forward. What was the year that this route was last updated again?
1993.
So obviously a lot has changed since 1993 with our technology and with the ways that we do farming. And so it could only be so up to date, but I think it still does give us some really good ideas in terms of what we can think about of where our food comes from and the resources that is needed to grow that food. And so,
and even if it is out of date, it still grows 30 tons of food or something, right?
Right, right. I think the greenhouses are really cool, and they do use some fun technology. But globally, if we think about how much food we need to grow for this growing human population, what percentage of that is in this specific type of greenhouse? I'd say it's a pretty small percentage. But what is amazing is that these technologies that are in Living with the Land is they've led to so much more improvements in terms of how we do vertical farming. And so, for instance, the nutrient film technique isn't necessarily used much anymore, but that has led to basically soilless indoor vertical farms. And so we are now using kind of that type of technology where we are able to get nutrients directly to plants to grow plants essentially inside of warehouses and all along stacks and stacks and stacks of indoor farming using a similar technique. And so we're getting there. We still haven't obviously perfected vertical farms. And one thing that I saw in my research is that obviously humans can't survive off of lettuce. Like lettuce is one of the easiest things to grow in that type of vertical farming environment, but we need a lot more than just lettuce to survive. And so yeah, I think it's cool and it's growing, but now we're starting to see things like farms in a shipping container. So you can actually buy a recycled shipping container. It can ship to anywhere in the world, obviously, on these shipping containers. And for like $2,000, you can buy a fully sustainable farm inside a shipping container.
I was thinking that maybe we should do that for, like, if you've heard of the Dirty Dozen, you know, the products that seem to have a little bit more pollution, a little bit more fertilizer and runoff. I was thinking that maybe we should do our own vertical farm for, you know, they include the strawberries, spinach, nectarines, apples, grapes, peaches, cherries, pears, tomatoes, celery, potatoes, and sweet bell peppers. However, some of those are kind of heavy, so I'm not sure if a potato would hang vertical up and down.
Right. Yeah, no, and obviously some of them come from trees, and so there's different challenges. But I think you're onto something, and that's a cool part of the last part of the ride in terms of the biotechnology lab and the integrated pest management. I absolutely think that we can do a better job and we can find ways to use less pesticide to make it so, like you said, that Dirty Dozen is a little safer and more available, whether it's through these newer vertical farming techniques or...
Do you remember what bugs they said they used the most to help prevent the pests?
I don't remember exactly, but ladybugs maybe?
Ladybugs is yes. And why?
Because they eat the eggs of bad pests.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the other one are wasps. But obviously they can't have them in the ride because they could attack a guest.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think there's just so much that you learn about when you go on that ride that you can then go into even more detail about what is more current in terms of the technology and the methods that are used.
Well, I really love the bug part too, because, you know, you just see the themes throughout Disney World. Like in Animal Kingdom, with their research, they realized that elephants really don't like bees. So they had farmers plant or do like beehives around their fields, and then the elephants would leave them alone, and that led to less poaching. And then I was looking up, do you know how Walt Disney prevents mosquitoes?
I think it's
based. And do you know how long that has been going on?
Well, I know in Florida, mosquitoes are a huge problem, but in Disney World, it seems like they're not there at all almost. And so I think it is a combination of the plants that they plant and the other bugs that they have around the area. I don't know.
Walt Disney actually hired the retired Army Major General William E. Potter, and he was known as Joe Potter. So William Joe Potter, he was an expert in civil engineering, and he worked a lot in Panama, which has a huge mosquito problem. So when Walt Disney was designing the Disney World Resort, he had Joe come in and help with the engineering. So they have what's called Joe ditches is what they refer them to, where there's all the water runoff because Florida gets a ton of rain. It goes through these ditches. It gets shunted away. All the buildings, none of them are flat. There's no standing water anywhere in the park. So it's just awesome. Instead of having to use pesticides to kill mosquitoes, just prevent them from even going there to begin with. I guess I'm an entomologist fan.
that's amazing. I think obviously when you can make life better by reducing mosquitoes, I think the methods that they use is super interesting, and it's always good to learn more about bugs and how they can help both human experience as well as human food.
Yeah, and if you are an entomologist, you can do a 6-month internship at Epcot. And I think that is who gave us she was our tour guide on our Behind the Seeds tour. So Behind the Seeds tour is a 1-hour tour. You can check into it right next to Soaring. And you go behind the scenes with an entomologist, and they take you. First, they show you the parasitic wasp, and then you get to walk by the USDA Research Center.
I think it's not always an entomologist that takes you on the tour. I think it depends. They have different specialties. Sometimes it's one of the agricultural specialists. Sometimes it's
ours was definitely a bug girl.
Right. But yeah, there's different experts, but they're all great and they do an amazing job. I think that the most important thing when you have kids, when you go on the Behind the Seats tour, because I think it's phenomenal and it's great for them to learn. You get to learn in detail about the different techniques and the just theory, the science that drives a lot of the Living with the Land greenhouses and the ride. And it's well worth the hour spent. But you do have to remember
kids
that
kids might want to be a little older.
Right. That is an hour. I think we went there with 6 kids at one time, and they were all under the age of 7 at the time.
I think, yeah, 8.
Under the age of 8. So 8. And the youngest was 1 at the time. And that was a bit much for them.
Right.
And so I think if you can do it,
like high elementary school or middle school on up, I think would be perfect.
Right. And timing it with your trip is important too. I think I heard one family do it right before they had brunch at Garden Grill, and they said it made the meal so much better because you got to learn about where the food came from and how it got to your plate. And so they said that just made it way better. And so you can make it so that the kids have fun and they make it part of their day. But yeah, no, I love the Behind the Seeds tour. I like the hidden Mickeys that you can search for. And I like how you get to learn about everything from the fish that they farm to the different plants and the different methods, why some are hanging plants, why they use a certain type of sand and all the different watering techniques. I think it's just amazing how, again, as we talked in our last episode, Disney does a great job focusing on their environmental impact and what they can do to reduce their footprint and also teach people about why it's important.
Right.
So the last part of the ride goes back into the dark and has some different movie clips about how farming and agriculture has evolved over the years. Kind of tells a story of how we've evolved as a species and how things like agriculture impact our everyday lives. And so getting to see the old time movie clips about kind of how farming worked when everything was mechanical, kind of human driven or oxen driven. And now all of a sudden we are able to grow food on a mass scale and feed our 7 billion human population and growing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's just a fun ending to the ride. And I think it also opens up some questions too in terms of what are the costs to the new technology that we have. And I think that's always a great discussion to have with your family in terms of, okay, we've now figured out how to grow food on a mass scale, but what are the downsides to that? What are the downsides to using pesticides? What are the downsides to using genetically modified GMOs? And so,
well, since they are indoors, like they have to do all their own, you know, normally insects cross-pollinate for them, but they have to do all their own cross-pollination, which is super time-intensive and money too.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think in terms of just that discussion, I was talking on more of a grand scale and all the rest of agriculture. And so, yeah, I think it's just a really important discussion to have. And there's so much out there that's kind of a pseudoscience. And so I just wanted to quickly talk about a review that I saw of the new show, Zac Efron's new food show.
Oh.
I don't know if you've seen it.
On Netflix.
On Netflix. And so his new food show, and again, I just bring up Zac Efron because he's a Disney star.
Alum.
I guess
yeah.
A Disney alum. He started with High School Musical back in the day. And so I think it's all, again, it's amazing how Disney's fingerprints and reach is just about everywhere in entertainment. But his show, Down to Earth, it's a cool show. I've seen a few episodes of it. But it's not the most scientifically rigorous show in terms of what they describe. But again, the heart of the show is great because I think he truly wants to help people understand how amazing the Earth is and that we need to be careful about how we treat it in terms of our food and just our overall consumption. And so he goes around, travels the earth, but there are a lot of pseudoscientific claims. And this particular review talks about all of the claims that they make in terms of the true impact of GMOs and vegan diets and all of these kind of things that have claims that might sound really cool but aren't scientifically proven. But what he talks about, what this reviewer talks about, is how important it is to have trustworthy communicators talking about science and the environment. And I think Disney does that with Living with the Land. They don't overreach. They don't try and say, make all of these ridiculous claims that aren't proven by science. They talk about agriculture and what they do in a way that's truthful, in a way that's scientific, and they actually have a lab on site where they have scientists working. And so they just do a phenomenal job at Living with the Land of being an honest scientific communicator, which again, Zac Efron's show tries to do, but they don't do it at the level that Disney can, because they don't, Zac Efron's show didn't have any sort of scientific.
This is why you can go to Epcot and your school will count it as a field trip.
Right. And yeah, I think there's so many amazing connections. I don't know if you also look up at the greenhouse in Living with the Land, you're going to see a common shape, the triangles that form that sphere over the greenhouse, mm-hmm. are the same triangles that are on the Epcot ball. And so we talked about that last week in Spaceship Earth, how, again, the buckyball formation or these triangular patterns allow to create a structure that is, again, self-sustaining. And so I just think it's so cool that they have those common themes thread throughout Disney. And so that's why Living at the Land is at number 39 on our list, is because it is an entertaining, educational ride, and it ties into one of our favorite restaurants, one of our favorite behind-the-scenes tours, and it's just a great ride overall.
I wholeheartedly agree. So, Steve talked a little bit of the isosceles triangles, but last week I asked for Spaceship Earth, how many triangles make up the outside structure, the geodesic sphere? Do you have any idea?
I think it was somewhere around 11,832.
Okay, that's a weird. Yes, it was 11,520. However, some are partially or non-existent due to like the support structures. So in actuality, there's 11,324, but very close, Stephen, very close. And the trivia today is that there is a mailbox in front of the farmhouse. And what number is on that mailbox? And that's it for this week. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you're doing well. We hope that you are managing the stress during these tough times. And we hope that we can provide a little bit of magic talking about our favorite rides on our countdown. And we wish you all the best.
As you wish.
As you wish. Thanks for listening. Please check us out at countdowntomickey.com, and you can follow us on socials. We're on Instagram under Countdown to Mickey. So thanks so much, and hopefully join us next time.